We'll see. It's one of those three. It's probably looking for them. Oh, miraculous. Okay, so I am tasked with taking three different assessment tools, the assessment tool for home, the assessment tool for work, and the assessment tool for communities. And what I've done is I've put a single presentation together on all of them rather than three different presentations. And I don't have any relationships with anybody, ever. Uh-oh, there we go. Let me make sure. Oh, there's a space in between. So I think that, you know, starting with Katie's presentation, but certainly we as people in public health know that we're not just what we eat. We're what we eat and what we drink and what we breathe and what we slather on our bodies. And so our assessment tools are essentially being created to try and get some sense of these varied ways in which potentially hazardous chemicals can get into our body. So I want to just start with something similar to the Ann Haynes Body Burden, the National Health and Nutrition Exam study. This was a separate little study that was done of 10 or 12 people that Commonweal did a couple of years ago. Charlotte Brody is a nurse. She never worked in a manufacturing plant. She, you know, wasn't an industrial worker at all. And they tested 214 chemicals, all of which should never be in the body at all of which have potential toxic effects. And in Charlotte, they found 87 at the time of testing. Now, mind you, the testing is blood and urine, and so it also doesn't say what chemicals are now residing in Charlotte in our bodies in the fatty tissue. And a lot of the most toxic chemicals that we know actually are lipophilic, and they reside in our lipids, essentially. And so this is showing us what's circulating and being excreted from Charlotte. And of these, you can see, now remember, if any of you ever read, of course, an insert on a medication, and it gives you the list of side effects, and you go, oh my God, do I want to take this med, right? Because, I mean, you know, including death and everything short of are the possibilities. And those are merely risk factors that are associated with the medications we take. Well, that's what we're talking about here, is that these chemicals that Charlotte was exposed to create these risk factors. And in some instances, the risks are much higher than the risks that FDA would allow for a medication. And in some cases, they may be lower. So you can, and the other thing to note is that with any given chemical that I'm going to be talking about today, there might not just be one health outcome. It might not just be neurotoxicant. It may be also a hepatotoxicant. It may be an infertility risk and so forth. So what we also know is that this, which is everybody's first environment, is now also polluted. And the way that we know that is that when they have done umbilical cord studies, our studies, not of the mom's umbilicus, but of the baby's umbilicus and umbilical cord, what they've discovered is some of the same range of chemicals that we are finding in adults are being found in newborns, meaning that they were circulating those potentially hazardous chemicals at the point of birth and before. And so from any nursing, public health, or any other nursing perspective, the idea that we are creating now pre-polluted babies is unconscionable. And a lot of this is a function of failed chemical policies. But the way that we're going to help folks to reduce their toxic load is we're going to get practical. And we're also going to get political. But I'm going to talk about practical today because that's this session. And there's a whole other discussion around chemical policies. But this is taken directly from the National Library of Medicine's Household Products website. And you can just Google Household Products, and it'll take you to the National Library of Medicine's Household Products. And just like with the personal care products, and in fact, they do have personal care products. It's not as elegant a site as Katie talked about. But you can go in and put by brand name the little thing that you put on the back of your pet's neck to keep them from having fleas. Or you can put in the kind of putty that you're using to work on your bathrooms by brand name, and you can find out the potential, what the chemicals are that are in that, that the manufacturing plant has disclosed. So this is really important, because what Katie talked about in personal care products, they'll often just say fragrance. Fragrance is not enough information to do any kind of toxicological search. So colorant, fragrance, and flavorant. You can't do anything with that. You can't search those. It needs to have the chemical name. But be that as it may, you can get a huge amount of information. And so you as a practitioner, but also you're more educated, and we do an assessment all the time about what our clients and patients and communities are capable of doing. This is also in Spanish, which is very good news. So this is too small for you to see, but I just wanted you to see that what these home assessment tools look like. And when you sign up for the listserv, we'll send you all of these tools. And once again, we welcome you to adopt them. And so we have the one on homes. We have the one on community assessment. And I'm going to talk more about each of these. And then I, with a group of nurses who are working with hospitals on greening hospitals, we've created one that's just an environmental health assessment for hospitals. But mind you, in our clinics, we may have mercury. We certainly have cleaning products. We have sterilants and disinfectants. We know that many of these are asthmagens, meaning they can cause asthma, and asthma triggers, meaning that they trigger an event in somebody who has asthma. And we've been really working on how we can trade out those kinds of chemicals with less toxic and non-toxic options, and also working on recycling issues. And for instance, many clinics in the country don't recycle small batteries. We discovered at the University of Maryland Medical Center that we buy 97,000 small batteries a year. We were not recycling them, we were incinerating them. So lithium, cadmium, mercury, all of that stuff, we were contributing to our body burden. And one of my graduate students a couple of years ago just said, unacceptable, and she created a recycling program for the hospital. So 97,000 less batteries are being incinerated and contaminating our bodies. And then this is Katie's. So I'm going to start with the home assessment, but I've woven some things through here. And when I am duplicative to Katie, I'll try and just scoot through that. So what's the number one cause of lung cancer in the U.S.? Smoking, right? Did you all not learn that somewhere in your formal education as a nurse? You did, right? Okay, so we know this. What is, and we know that we need to look at this question, obviously, when we're doing any form of home assessment or when we're doing a history and physical. How about the number two cause of lung cancer? Thank you. Now, I gave this talk at the Graduate School Open House the other day, just last Thursday night, and there were 200 prospective students in the audience. We have the only postmaster's certificate in environmental health. It's all online, and so I was talking about that. But there were 200 students in the audience. Not one of them said radon. They came up with asbestos. They had a bunch of different things. Not one of them. So what does that mean in terms of our capacity in prevention? We need to make sure that our communities know this. And the EPA, and Liz Blackburn, would you wave at everybody? Liz Blackburn is over there from the EPA. EPA has fabulous materials in many languages for us to help our communities know about radon. And there is no excuse for us not to be doing something on this one. So in terms of radon, the issue for it is also a colorless, odorless gas, radioactive, that seeps in. It's naturally occurring. It's not a contaminant of some bad guys upstream who are doing something terrible. It resides in the earth, and it winds up getting into the basement, but it also, when you've got a well, it also can get into your water. It can be released by a shower. So there are a variety of ways in which radon can get into a home, and there are some simple tests that people can do with that. And so when you get the full materials that we send you, we'll also send you a lot more details on how to move forward on this. Anybody here who doesn't address lead at some level or another? This has been a ubiquitous and critical issue for public health nurses, but we want to make sure that we're asking our patients that we understand the housing stock in our communities from the perspective of lead. How many of you know the elegant tools that are necessary to do a lead wipe sample? You need a baby wipe without aloe. You need a Ziploc bag. You need to be able to measure 12-inch square. Anybody here think they'd have a lot of difficulty finding this equipment? We should be, honestly, we should be teaching our patients and our new moms, women when they're pregnant, how to do this in their own homes. Just and the costs of doing lead dust sampling, $10 or thereabouts. A little bit this way, a little bit that way. There's no reason why we shouldn't be helping people do this. Now, we could also buy X-ray fluorescence equipment, a little bit more expensive than a baggie, and we can't teach everybody to do that. Assessing for carbon monoxide, Katie did a good job of talking about that. We also want to talk about wood stoves. Wood stoves we know can contribute to anybody in the home that is experiencing any kind of lung problem. This can contribute to that. And also from an outdoor perspective, it can contribute to, especially in like the Pacific Northwest where they rely on wood-burning stoves, can really contribute to poor air pollution. So we need to talk to folks about that, and we need to be reasonable, especially in this day and age of what's going on with energy costs. We need to be balancing that. We need to be reasonable, and this is always what we do in public health. We need to balance what our communities can do from a cultural, from an economic perspective. Also want you to think about this, which you may not. In a lot of homes in Baltimore and a lot of homes probably everywhere, when you've got very large families and suddenly you've run out of room in the first and second floor, you start renovating the basement. And so if you've got in the basement room and right behind this wall over here, you've got something like this and it hasn't been checked for a year or two or three, this creates an incredible opportunity for low-level carbon monoxide exposures. And I want you to know that the science that's been worked on at the University of Maryland in our toxicology program is showing that the carbon monoxide monitors go off at way too high a level. So that if you've got chronic exposures below which that carbon monoxide monitor would go off, you've still got some problems. And if you've got young children or, you know, teenagers who are always looking dopey and sleepy, pardon me, I have them or have had them, and they're sleeping in this area, the fact that they're falling asleep in third period at school may be a function of their low-level carbon monoxide problem as well as learning issues and other problems. So this is a real important and insidious one. The other thing for you to know is that if you've got an attached garage and you turn a car on in the garage and idle it just for a few minutes, inside the house, right, if you've got a contiguous door to a kitchen or whatever, that room can have carbon monoxide levels that are higher than the EPA safe levels for up to 8 hours afterwards. So what you need and we need to be doing with that is we need exhaust fans in our garages. And we need to idle them for as short amount of time as possible and get them out of the garage. And we certainly don't need to be heating up in cold climates, heating up our cars in the garage and just keeping it going, because if you've got a nursery up here and a mom who's staying home, you have now just created carbon monoxide exposures that are going to be potentially dangerous. So I think I'm going to also just to mention to clients, because this can end when we're purchasing things ourselves, that we should be looking at EPA Energy Star, which is the designation for being energy efficient, and that's contributing to the whole environment in a different way. So evidence of renovations, and Katie talked about that. These are the kinds of things you want to look at. And drinking water, which she didn't ask. So when we're doing our environmental assessment, one of the things that is really important for us as public and community population-based nurses is we should know before we start asking our patients where the water comes from in our community and what the general quality is. We should know who the providers are, whether it's coming from surface water or whether it's coming from groundwater. We should know that in the last year or two, what kinds of contaminants have been in that water, whether there's been a boiled water alert. We should know this, and we can get that information from our providers. But the very first question that we ask when we're doing a home assessment or we're working with clients is, are they getting public water? Are they paying for their water? Or are they getting it from their own personal well? And the reason that this is really important is because there is no requirement whatsoever for testing of your own personal well other than the day it goes in. So if you've got a well, if you've got clients and patients, if you're in a rural area, which you probably for sure are going to have private wells, we really want to encourage those folks to do a basic battery of tests for their water annually if possible. And once again, we have to work with our communities on the possibility of that in terms of costs. And if this is a community that you think cannot afford it, work with your state health department, work with others who may have labs that can contribute to helping to do this. So I just talked about that. Also, if you're on public drinking water suppliers are required to test the water, obviously, and they're also required to make that information available. And this was the name they came up with, because we wanted to call it the Right to Know Form, and they said, no, let's call it Consumer Confidence Report. So that's what they call it. But they're still responsible, nonetheless, for giving information annually to those of you who are purchasing water. And many of them also then contribute this report to the EPA. So you can go to the EPA and look up drinking water. In fact, I think I have a slide on this. Oh, by the way, just one little thing I added. Great new report on bottled water. If you have any interest in this, go to ewg.org. Fabulous report came out last week on bottled water. And it'll put you off bottled water and back on tap water, I have to tell you. So EPA also has some very good materials on drinking water. And when you go to this site, you will then be able to click on your state and then from there go to the area where you can get your own consumer confidence report from your drinking water supplier. I can be quite critical of EPA, but I don't just love Liz. I love a lot of parts of the EPA because I think there are some great folks there doing really great work and sometimes under great constraints. But if the EnviroFacts are a place where you can put in your zip code and then find out a range of information about whether there are superfunds or brownfield sites or what the drinking water issues have been and what the fish alerts have been and what the air quality has been, to the extent that they've been collecting this information in your region or in your zip code, which is very helpful when doing environmental health assessments. So other things that you want to ask people, you want to ask them the age of their housing stock and understand whether lead could be a contribution to the contaminants in their water. But the other thing that people will often say, no problem with my water, I have a filter. Well, what are the contaminants in your drinking water that you are filtering for? I don't know. Do you think your filter is going to filter for everything? Yeah. Is that right? No. So we have to be, and we have to be one step ahead of the public as public health professionals. So we need to be able to not talk about every kind of filter, but we need to be able to know where to go to help people know, okay, first you need to test your water to determine what's in it to figure out what you're going to filter out. So is it a microbe, in which case maybe you want to have a filter? Is it a VOC, a volatile organic compound, in which case you want a carbon filter? Is it something else, in which case you need to do something for heavy metals, and so forth? So a filter is not a filter. And so this is something that I think that, and we'll have lots of information on our site about that too. So other things which we want to ask them about, do you have, you know, the basic safety things. These are things that I'm sure you're already asking them about. Not everybody even knows what shelter-in-place supplies are, and that's hooking up with your preparedness folks and making sure that when they're doing this kind of thing, you can sort of, not sneak in, but you can integrate in some of the other environmental health stuff as well. So Katie talked a little bit about assessing for pests, or maybe you did pets. So maybe you did both. So that is another question to ask, you know, what kinds of pests they have, and then also what they do about those pests. And so it's really important. I just said this week because I thought it was timely. But you want to ask them what kinds of products they use for their pets, because a lot of them have potential for toxicity. And once again, also as Katie said, see, I'm doing it as Katie said. She's always doing as Barb said. That we need to, we can look up all of these products on the National Library of Medicine's database called Household Products, and be able to have informed statements to our clients and our communities about using these, but particularly when you've got young kids at home. I also want you to know that how many of you, when you purchase something in a can to spray in your bathroom and it says, I don't know, gardenia, how many of you think that there's actually a real gardenia ever been involved in the process of putting this stuff in that can? Everybody laughs, but everybody bought this stuff too, so it's just crazy making. They're mostly petrochemicals. Many of them have musks. Musk in them is a known carcinogen. So, okay, so it's going to smell like the bathroom, but it, you know, it goes away. But instead, I'm going to spray a carcinogen in there. So the next person who comes in gets to have a little fragrant and carcinogenic. You know, what's wrong with this picture? So we need to talk to people about fragrance. And I have a sister who has a real fetish about candles. And there are, you know, whole companies, whole stores, candle, candle, candle. It is really important that we understand what are in the fragrances that we are putting into our homes, because they are volatilized and we get to breathe them. And if they have potential toxic effects, we get to take in those risks, as does everybody else in our home. So we need to talk to people about fragrances. We need to make sure that our clinics and our hospitals and our schools are fragrance-free from a variety of products, but these are ones that are particularly interesting. So personal care products, the database that has been created is up to 30,000 now. I talked to Jane Houlihan. She's the one that does this database. You just Google Skin Deep and you'll be able to get to the database. And you can now really, really find out what are in your various, you know, your deodorant, your soaps, and so forth, those care products, and the products of the people that you serve. So this is the site to go to. You've seen it now twice. Also, when we're doing home assessments, especially if we're doing home assessments in folks who are ill, we want to make sure that we're looking at these kinds of devices and how they're disposing of them, and whether they're doing them safely from a needle stick perspective, but also that they're appropriately disposing of them in other ways as well. A very big issue right now for us as a globe, it's not just US, is what we should be doing with unused pharmaceuticals. We know that they are showing up in our water, and some of the times it's because we're excreting them in our urine, and that's how they're showing up, and we are going to have to address that with our sewage treatment plants and other mechanisms for dealing with sewage. But we also, in almost all group homes in Maryland, the SOP for disposing unused meds is still flushing them down the toilet. And we just have not now come up with a set of principles and guidelines that are science-based. Also, as noted by Katie, very often, or maybe not, maybe it's a different session, sorry, that very often they say incinerate them. You know, if you do a take-back, well, what do we know about combustion chemistry about incinerating? Why do we think that's the best thing to do with them? I mean, it's not science-based. We don't have that science yet. So this is something we are really going to have to be engaged in trying to understand what the science is. She showed you the mercury one. Also, asking people what they do in terms of arts and crafts. We know that people who do stained glass often work with 50-50 lead solder in doing that stained glass work, and we've seen lots of people that wind up lead poisoned doing that. There are just a variety of chemicals that people use, all kinds of caustics and adhesives that have VOCs, and that many of them are neurotoxicants. So asking them about those kinds of things. And as noted by Katie, we have one time in our life when we are needing to be cognizant of the most vulnerable population to the chemicals that are in our homes and in our communities. And it is a time, even though you're saying not to do any renovations, how many of you, when you had your first child, if you had your first child, put together some form of a nursery for them, right? And when you're pregnant with your first child, you don't have any others tagging along, so you pick out wallpaper and you're, you know, going to paint the this and the that. This is a very, very teachable moment and a really important time to talk to our populations about that, especially about renovation. We also want to talk to folks about mold. Mold is, 99% of the time, mold is a function of a moisture problem. So you can keep cleaning it up, but if you haven't addressed the substrate issue and the moisture problem, you're going to keep having it. So we have to help people understand why they have it, putting dehumidifiers in, fixing the leaking, pipes and stuff that are in the walls and the ceiling, the flashing on the home that's allowing, that's not in good repair, that's allowing the water to run down the walls, all kinds of things like that. We need to help people understand that that may be, in fact, why they have a problem like this. Garden and pet care, talked about those. In many of the provinces of Canada, they have now made it illegal to use pesticides and herbicides for cosmetic purposes, period. So that, you just can't do it. And so that's one direction that would really help us take care of this, which is just saying, we just can't use these products for cosmetic purposes. And I know that I have some lawn, and more of it is crabgrass and little clover things than the grass that I originally put in, but it's green, so who cares, right? So I think we have to get over this, some of the aesthetic, and think about how we're going to address that. Pesticides, there is a lot of fabulous information right now in integrated pest management, both using integrated pest management, which is a method of thinking like a bug and thinking what a bug needs, which it needs a good home, it needs a place to nest, it needs water, and it needs food, and it needs entry into your house. So if you can block the entry and then make sure you don't have available water leaks and food that's left around, that's like 75% of it. And then working at addressing other ways of minimizing the pests rather than going to chemicals that are potentially toxic. We also want to ask and you will know this if you're in a community, is there overhead spraying? Is there aerial spraying in the community? What we know about many chemicals that are sprayed for pest purposes, pesticides and herbicides, is that the active ingredient is biodegraded in the presence of sunlight. Well, that was pretty clever, right? What happens when the farm worker comes home and comes into the house and in a room like this in the house, or a north-facing room? What happens with the active ingredient? It doesn't biodegrade because it's not in the presence of sunlight. So what we do know about homes in the farm country is that they've got way more active ingredient and pesticides in their homes than outside. And so we need to talk about walk-off mats. We need to talk about taking, anybody ever been to Japan? The Japanese would never walk into a home with their shoes on, period. And in fact, I just have to tell you this real quickly. I lived in Japan for a little while, and they were showing a cops and robbers kind of thing where they were chasing each other and running through a house, and at the door, the cops and robbers took off their shoes in the movie. I mean, it is so forbidden to do that. It is so, anyway, it's really pretty funny. So there's no reason why we can't think about, especially also, I just need to mention this, in our urban areas, what we're discovering in Baltimore is the soot from the street sweepings exceed, in some communities, the EPA allowable soil standards for lead. They have exceedances for zinc in some of the communities, and they have pesticides and herbicides. So in our urban areas, taking off your shoes at the door and coming in with your socks or barefoot is probably a pretty good health idea. So we also want to make sure that when we're doing our assessments, that we're assessing for the good things as well. Do they have a local farmer's market? And if not, that's a public health intervention to think about. And we're getting hospitals in some of our most challenged communities in Baltimore City, and I know they're doing it in Oakland, California, and other places in Northern California. Kaiser is doing it, where they're actually sponsoring in their parking lots once a week a farmer's market. So looking at its absence is merely an opportunity for you to fill that absence. And looking at community gardens, having your communities have access to join community sustainable agriculture, which may be outside your community. But in many instances now and in many states, women who are receiving women, infant, and children funding and support can use vouchers to go to farmers markets and to participate in CSAs. So another thing that you want to look at. Then looking at the quality of green space in your community and whether folks have, whether it's a walkable community, whether there's tree canopy. What's the number one cancer that we're looking at in the now and in the future. Skin cancer. Look at this wonderful prevention. If in our urban areas we have tree canopy, we've done skin cancer prevention. And what a nice way to do that. We've also changed the energy use needs. We've created a piece of nature that is associated with mental health and a whole range of affect issues. So think about tree planting as a public health event. Carbon dioxide, they're just sucking up the bad stuff. So it's something for us to think about and be engaged in. And there are a lot of nonprofit organizations that do tree planting. And I don't know whether you're going to talk about the tree planting in your community. In Baltimore, we planted 1 million trees in the last 5 years. Makes a huge difference. So if you're, you can plant trees everywhere, too. So I want you to know that green spaces right now are happening everywhere, and lots more green roofs are going in. And so there are lots of ways to think about creating green space, which, once again, is a public health intervention for a lot of reasons. So other things to look at, vacant lots. Where are the kids playing in your communities? This is obvious to all you guys, but for some of our nursing students, I think I'm close to the end. I don't actually know. Because I combined all these things, now I don't know where I am. But we'll see. Tell me when it's 1 minute, and I'll just start to wrap it up no matter what. So looking at playgrounds and seeing, this is addressing not just the environmental health issues, but the obesity issues and the sense of community issues. Does your vacant lot, which obviously at one point had been something vital, does it look like a has-been? Can you create opportunities for putting in places where kids can actually play and then organizing some organized play around it as well as pickup games? Can we also make sure that there are trees around it and so forth? Our schools, we want to look at, are they walkable? I was raised in a Levittown planned community, post-World War baby boom planned community. Every single child in Levittown could walk to their grammar school. And most of the children actually walked home at lunchtime. That was when women stayed home, or many, not all. But is your grammar school walkable? How about the middle and high school? Are they walkable? Are they bikeable? This is an environmental issue, but it's also an obesity and general health issue as well, and really encouraging that. Do they have an integrated pest management policy at the school in your community? Are they buying organic food or a preference for organic food for their kitchens, or local and seasonal food for their kitchens? Have they done water fountain testing? When we did this in Baltimore a few years ago, we discovered to our dismay that we had lead in most of the water fountains in the Baltimore City schools. There, once again, the EPA has got something called the Indoor Air Quality IAQ Tools for Schools, which fabulous, fabulous sets of materials on how to assess your schools and what kinds of interventions, you can just kind of take their fact sheets, just reprint them. I mean, they've just got great stuff. And the National Library of Medicine, these are, I'm sure you're familiar with Medline Plus, but you may not have been as familiar with the household products, which has a lot of great information. And for those of you who are doing anything with students or teaching, Toxtown, which is in English and in Spanish, is a wonderful set of tools that helps you go to town, and then you can go to the school, the hospital, you can go to the beauty salon, you can go to a variety of places in town and find out what the potential health risks are associated with these different locations, and they've got really wonderful material. And it's one of those websites where it's like miles deep, so you can keep moving miles deep. But one of the things that they've done, which is really another neat thing that you can use, is you can put in an occupation and maybe nail salon worker, and you can find out what are the chemicals that they are commonly exposed to doing that kind of work. So that's a very helpful one when you're doing assessments too. This I need to tell everybody here about, because I met with the NLM, the National Library of Medicine people. They've got a very good database for developmental reproductive toxicology. It is not being used enough, and they are talking about ending it. And this is, you know, just as we're getting ourselves more involved in this, for us to not have that as a resource is really important. And so it would be great for the public health nursing section as a whole to be writing something to the National Library of Medicine saying how important it is, and the American College of Nurse Midwives and so forth. Also, it's really key that we integrate this stuff into our curriculum. I think I'm coming to the end. And that we talk about that the things that I've talked about in this talk, that we're making sure that when our nursing students are learning how to do individual assessments, doing their history and physicals, but also when they're learning their community assessments, that we're making sure that we're integrating this material into that. And so, why nurses? Well, first of all, is there anybody not a nurse in the room? Okay, so why public health people? Because we get it. And we recognize this is all about public health people. We totally recognize the wisdom of early warnings. And we are pathologically fix-it people. We cannot help ourselves. We cannot see a problem without immediately going to the solution. Other people, believe it or not, and I don't know how they do this, go, oh, that's too bad. Right? Do any of you just do that? Oh, that's too bad? No. It's like we're wired wrong. We have to fix it. But that's, you know, it's both our curse and our privilege and all other good things. We also care passionately about our individual patients, but about the communities in which we serve. And we are trusted conveyors of information, and that is why we need to make sure that we are science-based when we talk about environmental health risks. Because if we start going off script here, and by that I mean off the evidence-based facts, then we are no longer going to be trusted. Then we're going to be tossed into that wonderful group of people called environmentalists, who we love. But we are public health professionals, and there are distinctions in terms of the information and how we're going to convey it. And we're really comfortable with that. And we're comfortable with saying, I don't know, when we don't know something, but I'll find out for you, rather than making it up, which sometimes some of our colleagues do. That's really important. And this is also really, really important. When we go in and talk to policymakers, whether they're local supervisors or county council people or our state or federal policymakers, they listen to us. They listen to us in a very different way than they would to an environmentalist, even though they may be somebody who embraces environmentalism. They listen to us differently, and we need to use our voices because of that. And there are a lot of us. 1 in 100 Americans is a registered nurse. I don't know how many in 100 Americans is a public health professional, but there are a lot of us. And we understand the sort of inextricable relationship between the environment and health. We get this. We totally really do get this. And so there's one site called the Luminary Project, which is a website that has sort of hero and heroine stories of people who are doing really good work in environmental health. There are now 100 plus, maybe hundreds up there. If you're doing something wonderful in environmental health and public health, you need to be on the Luminary site too, because this is a way of us sharing that that capacity. And so I'd like us now to just imagine a world where the personal care products and household products are made without toxic chemicals, where we have classrooms that don't have asthmogens that are being potentially brought in, where we have homes and walkable communities and green spaces and so forth, and a future where the umbilical cord blood, when sampled, is not going to show up all kinds of potentially toxic chemicals. And with that, I think I'm done. And so thank you.
Those are Robins. Oh, okay.
Everybody sign this. I wanted to.